First, we are joined by Mark Little, the CEO of Kinzen. Before that, an executive of Twitter. Before that, the co-founder of Storyful. And then before that, a broadcast journalist and a presenter with RTE. It's quite the LinkedIn profile there, Mark. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon to you, Gavin.
It's quite the list of accolades, all right. We had asked you to come on this weekend to talk about the hostility between Donald Trump and Twitter, the social network that made him. But I suppose it's difficult not to discuss some of the scenes that we've seen in the USA in the last few days. And before I get your thoughts on it, I just want to play a little bit of audio. What you're about to hear is audio from a CBS television report. Now, the woman and the little girl you're going to hear are the wife and daughter of a man named Philando Castile. Now, he had been pulled over at a traffic stop in the midst of everything else that's going on in the US in the last few days. He had been asked to show his ID, so he put his hand into his pocket to pull out his wallet and to get his ID. The police shot him, thinking that he was about to pull out a weapon. And what you're about to hear is some recordings of the wife and daughter of that man who were in the back of a police car in the short aftermath after that.
Reynolds was handcuffed, clearly upset. The young girl comforts her mother.
Mom, please help me. Cousin's a screamer because I don't want you to get shooted.
Okay, give me a kiss.
I can keep you safe.
It's okay, I got it, okay? I can't believe they just did that.
I wish this town was safer. I don't want it to be like this anymore.
The pair pray, unaware Castile has died.
Please, Lord, tell us, give us a sign that Phil is okay. Please, Lord, I just need a sign. Please, Lord, give me a sign.
And tell God that we need a right home too.
Pretty heartbreaking stuff there. That's the wife and daughter of Philando Castile, not knowing at the time that he had already died from the gunshot wound he received by a police officer who shot him as he was pulling out his ID. Mark, that never gets any easier to watch or to listen to, but I wonder whether in your own time in the US, I know it's gone a little while back at this stage, but did you ever think that the ingredients were there, that there was this kind of powder keg waiting to go off like we've seen in the last week, or are even you taken aback by what we've seen?
I think on the issue specifically of police violence and the role that race plays in policing in America, this is the open wound that has been gaping in front of the world in the United States, for generations. I was struck yesterday by something that Martin Luther King said back in 1966. He said, you know, a riot is the language of the unheard. And for African-American people to see the list of people who have died in the circumstances we've just heard about. George Floyd killed in Minneapolis after a police officer put his hand, his knee on his neck for 8 minutes. So this is something that is happening at such a regularity and is not being addressed that there's just no surprise that we've seen what we've seen. However, there is a significant difference to what people are starting to call these days of discord in the United States, is that as well as the specific issue of police violence, we also have the United States caught up in a sort of a toxic feedback loop where every week there seems to be an issue that is so much more potent than the last one. And obviously that is being led and stirred up to a large extent by Donald Trump and his supporters, whether it's the issue of the lockdown, where we saw, you know, heavily armed vigilantes going into state capitals in the United States to try and reopen the government. People who support Trump, and he actually talks about quite positively, that's the broader context here. That's what's new. It's this sense that, you know, what Lenin once said about, you know, there are decades when nothing happens and there are weeks when decades happen. Mm. And I think that speed and severity of the rage that's gripped American politics, I think, is the broader, more sinister part of what we're seeing.
Is it maybe the case that there has always been perhaps so many acts of individual police brutality, but there wasn't always the means in people's pockets to record, to document, and then to share that?
That's right. And, you know, we'll talk about the negative impact of technology. But one of the benefits of technology has been that we are now, the whole world is watching, literally sometimes in real time. So the death of George Floyd was captured on camera by a bystander who quite clearly was seen to be challenging the police officer. So there is no excuse. There's nowhere to hide when we can have everybody with their phone in their pocket witnessing this, and also as well as this, social media and technology allows people to organize without the kind of central leadership that movements needed to have before. So Black Lives Matter began as a hashtag on Twitter. Me Too, that movement was accelerated by the fact that we could all talk about this in real time and we didn't need people to witness it, i.e. journalists. So I think that has obviously played, you could say, a positive role in that it's exposed what's going on. But it's also, I think, led to an overload of imagery and sounds like the ones we've just heard, which I think are also deepening the sense of rage and increasing the scale and the speed with which these protests can be organized.
You mentioned Black Lives Matter in passing there. I just see inside the last hour and a half or so, Twitter has sort of blanked its own Twitter profile, just with the Twitter bird is now black instead of blue, and its bio just simply reads Black Lives Matter, which perhaps isn't an illustration that Twitter has decided to maybe get off the fence, politically speaking, in the last week or so. And that brings me to the topic that we had originally expected to talk to you about, which is the fact that Donald Trump is now taking issue with specifically Twitter, but with executive action which could compromise or certainly change the way in which all social media operates. What do you make of the fact that Donald Trump, who has been fed so much by Twitter for so long, now appears to be biting the hand that feeds?
It's funny, the other day when I was listening to his response to Twitter taking action against his Twitter account, where he's trying to basically repeal 16 words in this section 230 of the Communications Act, which basically gave birth to the modern internet. And what it does is it gives these social media platforms a sort of an escape clause. It treats them as deliverers of information, a bit like the post office, rather than publishers of information. And the biggest beneficiary of that has been Donald Trump. He's been able to uncheck, say these things to millions of people on Twitter. So in many ways, it's like a turkey voting for Christmas. He's repealing this protection that actually was the reason partly that he built up the kind of massive political base that led him into the White House. So he would be the first person to suffer if Twitter and Facebook and other social media platforms had to take a harder line to edit and moderate the kind of content that's on their platform.
So why do it then? What do you think is his motive behind doing that then?
Because you have to understand, again, there's a broader context here. There's a method to the madness. Let's just call this the world of alternative facts. So we're seeing, for example, attacks by the police on media in an unprecedented way as part of these riots. And that's not by accident. When you have the President of the United States continually tweeting about fake media and talking about the media as the enemies of the press, what he's trying to do is position himself as the anti-elitist. He's taken on the big social media giants, the traditional media, and this is part of his appeal. Despite the fact he's the president of the United States, he's also leading, I think, an alternative movement of people who see themselves as fighting back against the establishment. And that's the great irony of the Trump presidency.
But is it not very difficult for him to kind of organize that kind of movement, to use Twitter and his Facebook page, and there's obviously slightly different messaging on each of them, to use them as his rallying means, when if he were to pursue this Section 230 thing, and then Twitter and Facebook and other bulletin boards that support him would all have to start editorializing and taking down a lot of his content, that he'd find it very difficult to be that rallying linchpin, because he probably may not get the fair crack of the whip on traditional broadcast media, but he would have completely neutered the one forum in which he's winning.
But remember, he doesn't have to get the majority. He just has to speak to his base. And so if he became, in his words, and he would definitely portray himself as a victim, if he is censored in his own mind by these platforms, that increases the kind of connection that he has with his base. And I don't see a widespread clampdown on Trump by the social media platforms happening. So he will play one off against the other. And that's one of the things we started to see this week when Twitter took its decisive action. Facebook seemed to shy away, saying it wouldn't be an arbiter of truth. So he is counting on two things. First of all, inflaming his base, increasing a sense of victimhood, and secondly, playing these social media platforms off against each other.
What do you make of Mark Zuckerberg taking that sort of hands-off approach, insisting this week that Facebook wouldn't be following the lead of Twitter by putting little appended messages onto Donald Trump's posts the same way Twitter has done? It seems a bit of a pivot away from what Mark Zuckerberg had said he would do before.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a widespread acceptance that there needs to be action against kind of political leaders that do outrageous and say outrageous things on social media. And obviously, Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey had both pledged to take action. You know, obviously, I have a background. I worked for Twitter. When I worked for Twitter, I would tell people that not all platforms have the same values or have the same value. I think in Twitter, there has been, with Jack Dorsey at the head, a much stronger explicit protection of freedom of speech in the past, but also I think a growing awareness of the unintended consequences of social media and the algorithms that power it. With Mark Zuckerberg over the past couple of years, we've started to see very much a sort of softly campaign where we have a lot of Republican strategists who have become advisors within his company. He has definitely paid a lot more homage to the Washington establishment. He has had dinner with Donald Trump. I think he realizes that even with the size of Facebook, which is larger than most nations on Earth in terms of its power, he needs to have some sort of connection to the establishment, the political establishment. So I think there is certainly a more diplomatic, let's put it that way, sense about Facebook's approach for the moment than there is with Dorsey, who definitely, I think, will be someone driven more by his ideals than he will be by his relationship with Donald Trump and whether he gets invited to dinner.
I don't know if there's a short answer to this, but if there is one, I'd appreciate it. Do you think that Twitter and Facebook would be taking the same approach as they currently are if there were a Democratic president who was playing fast and loose with the truth?
And that's the significant thing this week. The reason Twitter delayed taking this action is once it's taken this action, the genie's out of the bottle. They now have to show consistency with all politicians who go to extremes on their platform. And I think that's going to be extremely difficult to maintain that consistency. But I think, you know, it's something they'll definitely have to do.
Yeah, I'll have to do it around the world too. Mark, great to get your thoughts on that. Thanks very much for joining us this time. This
Thanks,
lunchtime.
Gavin.
That is Mark Little. He's the CEO of Kinzen, formerly of Storyful, also formerly of Twitter, and of course, still well known as being a former Washington correspondent with RTE.